Anyway, James chapter 1, we're looking at the book of James. So we've looked at the introductory material, and last week we looked at verses 2 through 4. Count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. That's a willful decision, not something that comes by feeling. But the reason we count it joy, verse 3, is that we know that the trying of our faith worketh patience. Verse 4, let patience have her perfect work. So the command is count it joy. The consideration is knowing that the trying of your faith worketh patience. And also the consequence. And then in verse 4, the caution, let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. In other words, let it complete the process. Now, some of you may have differing opinions on what I'm getting ready to say, but I like chocolate chip cookies when they're still gooey. You know, in fact, my wife didn't always like them the same way, so I got to where I would cook them, put them in the toaster oven, just cook a couple in the toaster oven so I could take them out whenever I was ready. And they're nice and warm and gooey, and if you just about have to eat it with a spoon, that's perfect. Okay, that's my opinion. Okay, maybe everybody may not agree with that, you know, but maybe you like them a little on the crispier side. But, you know, what some would say about the way I like cookies is they're not all the way done. Now, chocolate chip cookies, okay, it's a little better. I mean, if it's bread baking and it's still gooey in the middle, that's not as good as a gooey chocolate chip cookie. It just isn't. But when it comes to our maturity, the goal of trials and testings is that we may be perfect and entire, to be complete, not missing any pieces. So if we have a faith, if I could say it this way, that's not fully developed, not fully cooked all the way through, that's not appealing. So that's the caution. All right, now that brings us to verses 5 through 8. We have a condition. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. So, while there is a bit of a shift in thought here, the big picture thought has not changed. You have counted all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. And verse 5 continues with that. All right, well, how do I count it all joy? Well, if you lack wisdom, ask of God. How do I respond properly? How do I know when I need to, you know, just stick it out? As we said, the word patience has the idea of to bear up under a load or just to persevere. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. So this is how we do what we've been commanded to do in verses 2, 3, and 4. The condition here is kind of obvious, I think. What's the first word in verse number 5? If. Okay, so there's a conditional statement. If. Now in the New Testament, there's more than one kind of condition. You know, sometimes there's a condition and it may or may not happen. And then at other times, there's a condition, and even though it's stated as an if, it's pretty much already assumed that that's the case. For example, you know, if you're talking to your children, if you do that one more time, this is going to be your punishment. It hasn't happened yet, but it's likely that it's going to happen. That's the reason for this caution. Or maybe a mom says something like this: if you left those footprints on my kitchen floor, you better go clean them up before I get back in there. All right? Now, it's stated as an if, but mom probably already knows where they came from. She's already measured the size of the footprint, used a scanner app on her phone, and narrowed it down to the member of the household that wears that size shoe. Okay? She pretty much already knows. It's stated as an if, but it's kind of assumed, right, this is already the case. That's the way this one is phrased here in verse number 5. If any of you lack wisdom... And it's a statement that's assumed to be true. Yes, you do lack wisdom. You're going to lack wisdom. The word lack here in verse 5 is the same word as the word wanting in verse 4. Okay, it means to fall short, to be inferior, or to be deficient. So in other words, if your faith is deficient, it's not up to standard, or it's not fully developed. Okay, well, that was what we said in verse 4. In verse 5, if you lack wisdom, if your wisdom is inferior, if it's falling short of what is needed. So the assumption is, yeah, you're going to run into situations in life where your wisdom falls short of the task in front of you. If you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. What is wisdom here? This particular word, wisdom, is used a lot in the New Testament in several different ways. It's used of natural ability to understand things. It's used of the wisdom of this world. In Matthew chapter 12, it talks verse 42, it talks about the Queen of Sheba who came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Same word there. The Jews in Matthew chapter 13 were astonished at Jesus and says, "Whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works?" Luke chapter 2 says that Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. So this word wisdom is used several different ways. It's used of man's wisdom. It's used later on in 1 Corinthians to contrast the wisdom of God and the wisdom of the world. 1 Corinthians 1, Paul said, "God sent me not to preach the gospel with wisdom of words, lest the preaching of Christ should be made of none effect." 1 Corinthians 1:19, God says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent." 1 Corinthians 1:20 talks about the wisdom of the world. Verse 21, the wisdom of God. So this word wisdom is used a lot of different ways, but it has the idea of understanding, the idea of being able to know what is needed and to apply it. And those aren't always the same, right? Now, it could manifest itself in different ways. You could discern that you have a leak behind the refrigerator. So you can apply some observation and some accrued knowledge in this life, and okay, it's probably the water line going to the ice maker. I pull it out from the wall, I look at it, yes, I have a leak in the water line that goes to the ice maker. So then you either apply the knowledge that you have to replace that line and fix the leak, or you apply the wisdom of past experience and say, every time I mess with water, this doesn't go well. I better call somebody that knows how to fix this. Either way, that is taking knowledge and making practical application to situation. Now, obviously, I used a simple illustration that's more physical, but here we're talking about spiritual wisdom. There is the wisdom of the world, there is the wisdom of man, but there's also the wisdom of God. And here we're being told, if you lack wisdom, ask of God. We're talking about godly wisdom. We're talking about the wisdom that comes from God that we need to deal with life, and in this context, the wisdom of how to deal with trials. You know what part of that is, I think? Some of our questions sometimes are, okay, is this a trial or is this chastening? You ever wondered that? You probably have. I have. And it's kind of a natural question sometimes, but okay, how do I know how long to just bite my tongue? How do I know how long that I need to just continue in this direction, or when do I need to change course? If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. You ever been there, lacking wisdom? Well, if you're honest, the answer is yeah. Okay, God gives you children, and all the exciting events that lead up to the birth of the child, and then you're that first night or whatever after everything kind of calms down, and they've wrapped up the baby, and you're holding the baby, look at it. I mean, it kind of hits you. This thing didn't come with instructions. Where's the instructions? And I'm not talking about the biblical instructions on discipline and training and correction and things like that, but how do I know if he's sick or she's sick, or if they're just exhibiting their Adamic nature? How do I know how to treat these different things? There's a whole new world there. I mean, that's an example I think a lot of us can relate to. Okay, I want to do the best I can. How do I do this? Right? If you lack wisdom, ask of God. But in the context, when diverse temptations, trials of various shapes, sizes, dimensions, and appearances come, Ask God. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. That phrase, let him ask, sounds like, you know, a gentle statement, and it is, but it really is a command. It's an imperative. It's what is sometimes called, you know, a gentle command or a sweet command, but it's a command. Let him ask. So this condition is if you lack wisdom. The solution is let him ask of God. If you lack wisdom, and it's going to happen, then ask of God. Okay? The word ask means to ask for with a claim on receipt of an answer. So implied in this is it's not just why did the president make that decision? We all have those questions. But the likelihood that I'm going to get a direct answer on that question is very, very low, right? But, you know, there are times when a parent asks a question and, what are you doing? And the kid doesn't want to answer. But in that scenario, the parent has a demand or has an expectation of getting an answer, right? You're going to tell me. Here, the idea is ask of God with the expectation that I have a reason that I can get an answer. Now, is this okay? God is the genie in the bottle. You know, you rub the genie, you rub the lamp, the genie pops out, and you demand your answer. No, but why would we have an expectation that if I ask, I'm going to get an answer? God's promises, okay? God's promises are one reason that I can expect an answer. What is the basis on which I can expect an answer? Is it because, you know, I'm Mr. or, in some of your cases, Miss or Mrs. Wonderful? What's the basis upon which I can get an answer from God? Relationship, isn't it? In the same way that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily barge into every, you know, kitchen table discussion, but the kids that belong to that family will barge right into the kitchen table discussion and ask mom a question. Now, they may have to be taught the appropriate time, but they have an expectation, this is my mom, I can go and interact and I'll get acknowledged and received and so forth. But ask of God, the expectation of an answer starts with a relationship. It's because we are the sons of God, and it's because of the promises of God, because he's told us we could. Okay? It's not being rude or assuming too much in my own favor, presumptuous, if I've been told to. You ever told somebody, if you need something, let me know, and I'll help you, and they never tell you anything? Yeah, I see a lot of head nods, yes. Okay. If you tell somebody that, and they say, hey, you know when I said if you need, you know when you said if I need something, I could use some help with this. Are you going to go, how dare you? You ask me to help you with that. Fix your own problem. No, I don't think any of you are going to approach it that way. In the same way, because God said, if you lack wisdom, ask, then we can have an expectation, okay, he gave me the opportunity, then I can go ask. And that's what the rest of the thought is in just a minute about not upbraiding. Okay? But the basis on which I can ask is a relationship as a father and a child, and then the promises of God, the fact that he told me I could. That's the reason I can ask with an expectation of receiving an answer. Now, it may not always be the answer I wanted, maybe not always be the answer I expected, but as a child of God, we can ask for things and expect that our Father will answer that. Let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally. It's interesting here, the giving, the way it's phrased here, the giving happens at the same time as the asking. So in other words, whenever we ask, God gives the wisdom that we need. All right? That giveth to all men liberally. Okay? So God gives freely. But the word liberally here does not mean exactly what I thought it meant. It has nothing to do with politics. All right? But, you know, when we sing, we think of liberal, or we say liberally, we tend to think, generously, and that's the application that we have today. But the root meaning of this word means simple, sincere, no guile. It means, you know, simplicity in verbal expression, which came to be, okay, just, it came to be used as, you know, a straightforward and then eventually abundant. The idea that God gives to all men liberally is it's a simple, straightforward, no hooks in it, no trick statements, anything like that. You know, you have no idea what's in the terms and conditions. You just click the little box that says, I agree, so that box will get off your screen, right? There may be one or two of you in here that read it, but most of the time you don't, unless it's something very, very significant. You want to read all of that first. I'm the one that wants to read those things sometimes. You're getting ready to sign your life away, signing a mortgage on a house. I'm just going to sign all these papers and not read what I'm signing? I don't think so. I'm going to read them. But why do I think I need to read it? Because I think, okay, maybe there's some hooks in there. Maybe there's some statements in there that I need to be aware of. God doesn't give wisdom that way with hooks or problems built in. God gives in simplicity, straightforward, no trick statements, nothing like that, okay? It's the idea of sincerity and openness, no guile, no tricks, okay? He giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not. The word, if the oldest dictionary I know of for English is Webster's 1828, and that old definition of the word liberal has the idea, again, of not selfish or of self-interest, but open and free, and then it's morphed into our use of generous. Give it to all men liberally, and upbraideth not. This also happens at the same time as the asking. So when we ask of God, He gives, and He does not upbraid. The word upbraid means to find fault in a demeaning way. You ever been there? I have, probably on both sides of it. But, you know, you ever ask a question, hey, how do you do this? You don't know how to do that? That would be to find fault in a demeaning way, right? Hey, you ever finally get so frustrated in the store, you try to find an employee and ask, hey, where do I find, you know, cups? Where do I find forks? Where do I find, you know, nuts and bolts? Can't you read the signs? Look right there. You know, that would be a way of giving an answer that is also condescending and demeaning. Here we're told that when God gives wisdom, He doesn't do it in a way that's condescending. He also doesn't do it, this word also sometimes is used in the sense of a rebuke or a reprimand. He doesn't say, why are you bothering me with this? He told us to ask. I mean, it's the difference between your kid saying, hey, Dad, how do I do this? And you can say, you don't know how to do that. Or you can say, oh, okay, come here, let me show you. Bring it over here, I'll show you how to do it. That's the way that God interacts with us. He gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not. Now, which approach is more likely to encourage you to ask for help again? The whole, you don't know how to do that? Or, sure, come here, let me help you, I'll show you. Which approach is more likely to have you ask for help from that same person again? God deals with His children if we take Him at His word, if we say, okay, He said I could come ask, so I'm going to go ask. He deals with us gently and straightforward and without hooks in it, liberally, and without demeaning. Have you ever refused to ask for help because you didn't want people to know that you needed help? That's the stereotype of men with directions, right? I generally am more frustrated with the wasting of time and that kind of thing, so I'm not going to go too long before I stop and ask for directions. And see, now we can kind of anonymously ask Google Maps for directions. I don't have to walk in a store and admit I don't know where I'm going, right? But isn't that the stereotype? Well, if I ask for directions, they'll know we're lost. And it's like, everybody in this car knows we're lost. Let's just find out where we're going. You know, sometimes there's that fear of, well, I don't want to admit that I don't know what's going on. You know, that same thing sometimes keeps us from asking of God, doesn't it? Here's the difference. People may or may not know where we lack, or you know, that we're lost or confused or whatever else. Are we fooling God at all? Not in the least. God knows if we are lacking wisdom, if we are lost, if we are confused, if we are way out in another county from where we're supposed to be. He already knows. He just wants us to acknowledge it ourselves and ask Him for help. And when we do that, He doesn't rebuke us. He's like, okay, I'll be glad to help you. I'm just waiting on you to acknowledge it. I think this one reason God gives us children is so that we see the reflection of ourselves in how we deal with our relationship with God, right? I mean, when a kid gets a little bit of size on them, one of the things they learn to say quickly is, I do it myself, or something like that, right? Or you offer them help. No, they don't want help. Have you ever just had to sit back and say, okay, I'm going to let you just simmer on that until you figure out you need help. And then once you figure out you need help, I'll help you. But if you're not going to accept help, I'm not going to waste my time. I mean, we've all been there, right? I think sometimes that's the way the Lord has to deal with us. Okay? You want to be a hard head? Then keep banging your head against the wall. And when you finally admit that you need help, come ask for wisdom. Farmer told me years ago, if you're going to be stupid, you better be tough. That wasn't an endorsement of that approach. It was just kind of an observation. You know, if you refuse to ask for help, you refuse to learn from others who try to help you, then you're going to have a lot of hard knocks and bumps and bruises. And when we finally come to the place where we say, all right, Lord, I need wisdom, He gives liberally and upbraids or demeans, rebukes not. And it shall be given him. You have the statement there at the end of verse 6. That is a promise. It shall be given him. All right, verse 6. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. Okay, this is the only condition that's placed on it. Thank you very much. This is the only condition that's placed on that. Is let him ask in faith. If you lack wisdom, ask. Only one condition put on that. Let him ask in faith. This is the same statement here. Verse 5, let him ask. Verse 6, let him ask. Both of those are commands. So really, verse 6 is telling us how we should ask. Let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. Okay? So let him ask in faith. Have you ever either thought this or said it out loud? Well, I can't find it. So I guess I'm going to have to ask for help. I doubt I'm going to find anybody to help me, but I'm going to at least try before I leave the store and go somewhere else. You ever had a similar thought like that? That is not asking in faith. That's not a confidence of getting the right answer. And sometimes those reputations are well earned. But when you ask God for wisdom, is God going to have to say, I don't know how to help you? I mean, that's an obvious answer. I'm just trying to get us to think a little bit. You're not going to take a problem to God and God say, I'm sorry, I don't know how to help you. Go ask your mom. Go ask dad. I don't know. God doesn't have to make those kind of statements. When you go to God and say, Lord, I need help, He has the answers. That's the basis of our faith. Because He's the Creator, because He's almighty and all-knowing and everything else that we know about God, I need to ask with confidence that if I request wisdom, He will give it. Well, I'm going to pray for wisdom, but God does those kind of things for pastor, but probably not for me. God does that for, brother so-and-so, sister so-and-so. They're a better Christian than me, but I'm probably not going to get an answer. No, that's not the attitude God wants us to have. You are a child of God. You can go to God and get an answer. But let him ask how? In faith. And then that is reinforced here with an illustrating statement. Nothing wavering. Now, When we think of wavering, do you think of physical or mental? Okay, this particular word here, nothing wavering, is actually a word that refers mostly to a mental process. It's a word that's used other places in the New Testament in different ways that has the idea of discernment, or, you know, to be able to sort things out or to arrange or separate. It means to evaluate or to judge. Okay? So, when you take that, the idea of discernment, okay, I got to figure this out, I got to think things through, I got to make a good decision. When you take that to the extreme, what do you get? Overanalyzing. Overthinking a situation. That would be the idea of wavering here. Let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. Well, you know, maybe I won't get an answer because. The idea of wavering here is that's why I said it's a mental process. It's the idea of trying to discern yes, no, pros, cons, whatever, you know, and you're going through that evaluation process, but then you have to get to a point where I'm going to say, all right, I asked God to help me. Best I know, this is the way God's leading me, I'm going to go with this. Let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, not, you know, continually tossing it back and forth in your mind. And then it goes on to say, for he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. What was James's location? I mean, he was from Israel, right? So the Mediterranean was right there. They all could observe that. Driven with the wind and tossed. We understand that, I mean, even just within the last week or so, there was a large storm. It was a tropical storm. I think it upgraded to hurricane before it, you know, crossed land in Florida and South Georgia. But, you know, when you get a storm that has really strong winds, what happens to the normal pattern of the waves in the Gulf or the ocean? You know, you've got a normal pattern that happens with the tides and the normal in and out. When you get a strong wind, like a tropical storm or a hurricane, then what happens to the waves? They're much larger. They're much more intensified. And it's kind of interesting, if you like that kind of thing. It's kind of interesting sometimes that depending on the direction of the storm, I mean, if you live somewhere, you kind of know by observation, okay, the waves go this direction, whether it's, you know, east to west or south to north, or, you know, they kind of go right to left is where, when I stand here, this is the way they come in and go out. But if you get a big enough storm, it can push the waves a completely opposite direction from the way they normally go because of the wind and the storm and all of that, right? The wind, so the waves are not stable in and of themselves. They are subject to that outside force and that outside pressure. So the idea of being like a wave of the sea driven with the wind is to be blown in whatever direction the wind is pushing. Tossed, driven with the wind and tossed, I think is a related concept. The root word of tossed here has to do with the blowing of air. It could be used of the billows, you know, if you're going to blow air on a fire to get it hotter for a metal worker or whatever. But also has the idea of, you know, you take a leaf on a tree, if the wind is blowing, what happens? It's tossed to and fro, right? It's blowing back and forth. You get a flag, or, I don't know, does anybody still put laundry on the clothesline anymore? My mom used to do that. I don't think she does it now. But when I was a kid, she did it partly just to embarrass us by hanging our whites out in the backyard so people could see it, you know. But, you know, if you get enough wind and it's flopping back and forth, that's the idea here of back and forth and back and forth. You see how that fits in perfectly with the wavering and the, you know, over-analyzing in your mind, overthinking something? It's all the idea of back and forth, back, yes, no, maybe, what about this one? No. I'm going to ask in faith. If I ask God, He's going to give me an answer. When He shows me, I'm going to go that way. That's asking in faith. Nothing wavering. He that wavereth is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. Okay, then you have the result of that. in verse number 7. Let not that man think he shall receive anything of the Lord. Again, this is a command. This is another one of those gently phrased commands, but nonetheless, it's the word think here is not the normal process of evaluation, but rather this word think means to suppose. It's translated in John chapter 21 where John said, there were many other things which Jesus did, the which if they should be written, I suppose even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Philippians 1, Paul said, one preached Christ of contention, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my bonds. That's the idea here of think in verse 7 is don't suppose, don't let yourself go to this conclusion. It's even phrased in such a way that we could say it like this. Stop thinking that that kind of man is going to receive anything of the Lord. Don't think you can go to the Lord without the confidence. Well, maybe God will hear me, maybe He won't. Maybe God knows the answer, maybe He won't. Maybe God will lead me, maybe He won't. That's not going to please God. And supposing that that kind of approach is going to get an answer is to stop, is what verse 7 is saying here. Let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. But verse 6, that's how I get an answer. Let him ask faith, nothing wavering. And then you have the third confirmation of this same idea in verse number 8. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. The word double-minded here, as far as I can tell, this word is only used in the book of James. It's used here in chapter 1, and it's used again in James chapter 4, verse 8. Draw nigh to God, He will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. And it means exactly what it sounds like, to be of two minds. It's the idea of looking, you know, being on both teams and not picking a side. Now, I've seen some things where maybe a mom has athletes for children, and one kid went to this school and one kid went to this school, and they get somebody to custom make a jersey where half is for one team and half is for another. I don't think that would necessarily fall into the same category because she's pulling for her family. Okay, but if someone is just, okay, who's winning, that's who I'm pulling for. Oh, I pulled for them last week, but now I'm pulling for the other team this week. That would be an example. But the idea of being double-minded is not to be settled. It still ties right in verses 6 and 7 with wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed, wavering back and forth and being lacking faith, lacking that stability. And that's what it says, a double-minded man, the guy that's of two opinions, who has not solidly landed somewhere. A double-minded man is unstable. Did Jesus give any examples of a double-minded man? Yeah, I think He did. He said, you cannot serve God and mammon. You'll either love the one and hate, He said it, no man can serve two masters. You'll love one, hate the other, hate one, love the other, but you can't serve God and mammon. I mean, that's an example that we're all familiar with, I think, from the Gospels, of being double-minded, of trying to lead two separate lives, trying to please two groups of people, trying to fit in both places like that in ways that are contradictory. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. The word unstable here means not set, not established. Okay? You can have, in a literal sense, you can have things that are unstable. Think of it this way. You're redoing the back deck and you got the boards off the steps, but you need to get up and down, so I'm just going to set a board on the step for now so I got something to step on. But it's not screwed down yet. Okay, if I have to be very careful how I place my weight on that thing, or it's going to slide on me and I'm going to fall. That's unstable. There's a lot of ways in which we could illustrate that. The idea of being unstable, not fixed, not established. And the person that's double-minded is like this. They're blowing in the wind. They're not established. They're not grounded. What should my anchor point be? How do I become established? It's faith. In verse 6, ask in faith, but who am I asking? If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. My anchor point is the God who created me, the God who saved me, the God who promised to help me, the God who said He's my Father and He would love to develop me as His child, that's my anchor point. I've got to trust Him, I've got to follow His instructions, and when He tells me I have to do something, I'm going to follow it. That's part of the nothing wavering too, right? Because verse 2 says, count it all joy. Does that make sense? But when He says, count it all joy, I've got to follow those instructions, nothing wavering. When He said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you, I've got to follow that, nothing wavering. When He says, give and it shall be given unto you, even though that doesn't make sense, I've got to follow His instructions, nothing wavering. Does that make sense? You following me here? That if I'm double-minded and unstable, then I haven't committed to, okay, if God shows me something, then that's the way I'm going. But my stability comes when I say the God who created me, the God who saved me, the God who knows everything, knows best, and when He shows me or when I discern from His Word this is God's instruction, then that's what I'm going to do, whether it really makes sense to me or not. That is where my stability comes. That is where my confidence comes. That is, if you lack wisdom, ask of God, ask in faith, nothing wavering. Stability doesn't come from my intestinal fortitude, my personal constitution necessarily, my personality, my background, my knowledge, my experience, whatever. Ultimately, that stability and that confidence comes from the character of God, not from us. Aren't you glad that I can depend on God who doesn't change instead of me who struggles with it all the time? I am. So that is the condition here in verses 5 through 8. Next time we'll look at the next section here in verses 9 through 12. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, thank You.